So welcome back. It's a pleasure to welcome back to UVA Willis Jenkins, who fortunately gets back here fairly often, not only to see family in Madison County, but to speak in various institutes and departments here. Willis is Margaret Farley Assistant Professor of Social Ethics at Yale Divinity School. He's the author of this wonderful book, Ecologies of Grace, Environmental Ethics and Christian Theology, that Oxford published in 2008, which also won a Templeton Prize for Theological Promise. That's fantastic. I actually didn't know that. When did you win that? A couple years ago? Wow. He is the co-editor with Jenny McBride of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Martin Luther King Jr., and editor of The Spirit of Sustainability. And he is currently at work on a book on sustainability, social justice, and Christian ethics, which we may hear some about today. Thanks.
Thank you. I'm not really sure that I do lived theology, so I'm hoping that you can help me discover if I might. Here's sort of the warrants for supposing that I might. I'm trying to write this book, Sustainability, Social Justice, and Christian Ethics, in a pragmatic style. I'm actually explicitly defending a pragmatic strategy of Christian social ethics. And so the book's, by pragmatic, I mean it starts from problems instead of starting from theories and ideas. And so I'm trying to take a series of representative problems seriously: climate change, urbanization and homelessness, efforts to overcome poverty, and efforts to conserve biodiversity, and think about how people are generating responses to these new kinds of problems that they don't have resources for. So I'm interested in creativity, how communities generate new moral concepts, or make the concepts that they have, the repertories that they have, do new things, make them capable of creating new kinds of social action. And I came to this in part because shortly after I arrived into Yale with this book on theology and the environment, in a position of social ethics, I was asked, well, what do you think theology does for social ethics? And I didn't have a very good answer to that, really. I just thought, well, you know, here's theology of the environment. Why do I need to tell you what it also does? I've come to think that's actually not just a question that social ethicists have to answer, but it's a critical question, both in the field of Christian social ethics and in the field of environmental thought, where there's a similar kind of animus of criticism of this received canon of environmental theories that focus on what is nature and what is its value, and misses how actual civic communities respond to and interpret problems, and then what moral resources they might have within them. So there's this field of environmental pragmatism trying to help scientists and humanists work together to help communities resolve the problems that they can with the resources that they have. And there's a big debate about whether that's a good thing or not. So I've been using these different kinds of pragmatism, and this is the third time I'm here at UVA to talk about the strategy. And some of you in the room have heard this now for the third time. And so I have to say, first of all, this version is somewhat admonished by your previous objections, so you can listen for that. But also, I think I'm here in part because of some of your responses. When some of you were good enough to read this, read a proposed chapter, some people said, well, isn't this a kind of lived theology? I think Tim said that, and Chuck Matthews said it. And so then I said, well, I hadn't thought of it that way. And so I emailed you and said, I think I'm accidentally doing lived theology. Can you help me figure out whether that's what I'm doing? And so you've called me here to give an account. And also I was told that I should look again at Mary Fulkerson's work. And so I had the opportunity to do so for this. And you did tell me that.
Sorry.
Thank you. Okay. So here's just a small bit of the methodology part of a book about Christian social ethics. A popular view of Christian social ethics supposes that its task is to apply theology to social problems. Authentic Christian engagement with society on this view starts from fundamental moral values and then works down toward concrete situations. Paul Ramsey in Basic Christian Ethics expresses the intuition well. Before there can be a Christian social ethic, understanding of the fundamental moral perspective of the Christian must be deepened and clarified. First, work out the moral meaning of Christian faith and then see about applying it in practice. And he notes that this basically allies Christian ethics with philosophical idealism, that you have to be for philosophical idealism if you're going to do Christian ethics. Well, so as we now know, well, that in theology and religious study, there's a number of theorists who take issue with that. So we have materialists and pragmatists and ethnographic and lived theology approaches that do everything that we've been talking about. So for Christian ethics, my discipline, this turn toward lived Christianity draws ethicists into closer contact with how the faith is enacted, embodied, and inhabited. It lets ethical interpretation arise from how Christianity takes shape as a way of life. For me, however, working on these new and overwhelming problems, it creates a real vulnerability as well. It makes ethics vulnerable to the incompetency of everyday Christianity. I don't mean the perversion of Christianity from its ideals. I mean just that it is incompetent to new kinds of social problems. It has not yet produced the kinds of moral imagination or practices that would make sense of it. So consider the problem of climate change, which I'm trying to do. The gap between the complexity, the wickedness of the problem, and Christian responses seems not merely a failure to realize some implicit ethos of Christian life, and I don't think it's really convincing to say that climate change is the direct result of Christian metaphysics. I think it's just a failure of religious imagination so far. A failure to be able to make this problem matter within a way of life. Even among those few communities who are attempting to respond, the actions seem sort of inadequate, pathetic sometimes. So for Christian ethics to work from lived responses to climate change and still hope to eventually offer an adequate ethic, or at least point communities and ethicists to the road toward an adequate ethic, it has to suppose that new possibilities of Christian life can be learned and invented through responses to social problems. Ethics needs to suppose that climate change can be an adaptive occasion, pressing communities for theological innovation that makes the moral repertory of Christian life competent to new challenges. So on this view, the task of ethics is not just to interpret Christian responses, explicit or implicit, cognitive or embodied. It's to find, to critique, and to cultivate the trajectories of theological creativity. And that means not working with just any community in general, but finding the interesting ones, finding those who are beginning to invent in some way. Because for the ethicist, we need that creativity as a way to work at once with and beyond lived Christianity. In order to work with the incompetency and the uncertainty of Christian practices and use that incompetency as a resource, not as something to be overcome, but as a kind of font. Doing Christian ethics this way is not a matter of articulating moral genius, of providing the vision of sustainability and social justice that will orient a new world faith or something like that. Tracy West, Disruptive Christian Ethics, the counterpoint to basic Christian ethics, contests the assumption that Christian communities await the specialized knowledge of great thinkers about the fundamental moral perspective of Christianity in order to then confront social problems. Christian ethics is not something brought into a context, she is insistent. It's rather activity, in her phrase, waged through community, and so produced through contextual engagement. West observes the legacy of Reinhold Niebuhr, whose analysis of prospects for racial justice amidst the realities of power and pride can seem to presciently describe civil rights strategies of the 1960s. It looks as if Niebuhr works out a theory which is then later implemented by King, who translated it for a waiting community of action. However, says West, if we think of ethics this way, with Reinhold Niebuhr as the genius behind King's thought, and King as the genius of a movement, it, quote, conceals the multiple actors and innovators in the moral dramas of history and reinforces the supremacy of whites in our understanding of how moral knowledge is generated. West points to a Harlem network of agents bubbling with social creativity and strategies similar to those that Niebuhr was proposing while he wrote in his office just blocks away from them. Now, the methodological point here is not just that it would be good if theologians and ethicists were committed to struggles against oppression and struggles against poverty. It's that, and this is a characteristic liberationist epistemic stance, that those struggles are sites where communities invent practices that sustain the meaning of their faith in the midst of contexts that would otherwise overwhelm it. I was helped recently to read that creative theological thinking arises from the scene of a wound. Is generated, says Fulkerson, by a sometimes inchoate sense that something must be addressed. While Fulkerson is writing about a particular community, I thought that her morally charged sense of situation holds for how I'm describing more generally the condition of social problems and their challenge to Christian communities. Churches face a situation that faces an inchoate demand, a wound. And in this case, a wound so confounding that it still eludes interpretation as a wound. It's difficult to name just how it is a wound and how it is an injury, and that's part of what makes global impoverishment and climate change situations that, so far, suppress interesting creative responses. So, I think the ethicist can focus on the tensions in that gap. By focusing on the tensions between theological production in, yes, professional and lay, in systematic and implicit, in organic ways, all the ways we're talking about theological production. Look for the tensions between theological production and the apparent demand of a problem. In that way, Christian ethics does not need to arrive to the scene of social problems with an already complete theory, with the principles of an answer. In fact, on this view, ethics begins in recognition of incompleteness, of something that compels a response not yet given. This production may not necessarily happen through self-critical reconsideration of a community's moral beliefs about the world. And I think this is a note that has come up often. I mean, what people say about what they believe may be, in fact, the least interesting part of lived Christianity. And for proof, I mean, see denominational statements on climate change. I mean, this is like the least imaginative way of responding. The interesting moral production happens as a community's actual life changes, as European churches try to love their neighbors by purchasing carbon offsets grown by partner churches in East Africa, or as South American-based communities rally in support of legal rights for Mother Earth, or as South African evangelical youth ministries incorporate birding into spiritual formation. Now, all three of these things are weird and inadequate, but they're interesting, and they're starting to do something. There's a trajectory of innovation there. So as communities do these things, as they cook and landscape and pray and preach and walk and purchase carbon offsets differently, they invent new moral capacities from their repertory of faith, and I think may begin to make their way of life more competent to answer the demands of the wound. So this strategy supposes that Christian ethics should interpret difficult social problems in relation to communities already creating live strategies of response, rather than what is typical, especially in eco-theology, proposing an arrangement of symbols and metaphors and beliefs that could, if implemented and adopted and if they seeped into my moral consciousness, could lead to new kinds of action. Instead, a pragmatic strategy supposes that the most important interpretive resources lie in what a community is doing, however problematically and imperfectly. What a community says it believes, and even what it already does, matters less than the potential of the strategies it is organizing. Ethicists can help realize the potential of those strategies by cultivating and criticizing a community's initial responses, working to make their trajectory more competent to the problems they face. Okay, so that's my general view about how Christian social ethics might work with problems. And what I'm saying is that this is, in a sense, the formal object of the field of social ethics. Not what are moral beliefs, but where are these processes of invention, and that the work of the ethicist is to try and criticize and cultivate them. So now I just want to say a few things about the view of culture and the view of the relationship of theology and culture, and the role for beliefs within those two views that's entailed in this approach. That third point about the role of transformative beliefs, that transgresses the usual allowance of pragmatist commitments. And it raises questions about what counts as a living theological community. So I'm going to state the first two really briefly, what the kind of culture that goes with this and the view of theology and culture, and then turn to that about the role of transformative beliefs. Okay, so first, a pragmatic strategy of ethics understands moral culture in terms of course, everyone's favorite, embodied habitus by Bourdieu, or learned repertory by Anne Swidler, who I found actually also really helpful about thinking about culture as a deployed response to everyday problems in the world. against a view in which culture shapes activity by ideal worldviews organized by a governing logic or guiding set of values, a pragmatic view supposes that cultures shape agents into patterns of action. Those patterns of action carry ways of interpreting the world by bodily interacting with it, through bodily interaction with it. They're always under pressure to change as the context changes or as new problems arise. In that case, actors create adaptive cultural change by arranging the various elements of a cultural repertory, which includes worldviews and symbols and ideas and practices and, you know, how you cook, in support of some new pattern of action that seems to afford better interpretive action with context. Okay, now that's a real quick summary of Bourdieu and Swidler, but the way I put it admits a fair bit more of adaptive, meliorist social change than I think is actually there in Bourdieu. I just want to note, so we're all celebrating the habitus, but the habitus is a pretty fixed thing. And the improvisation within it is just to sustain that fixed disposition. So, you know, hoping for transformative social change out of a habitus, you have to have something that breaks it and that bends it. And in fact, I mean, I think that one of the greatest explanations of Christian North American denialism about climate change might be what Bourdieu talks about as an avoidance strategy, which is part of the habitus, that what it does not, what it can't, what exceeds its ability to improvise and bring within the habitus, it just doesn't see, right? So something threatens the whole habitus and doesn't, it won't invent. So that's, I think that's a problem, that's a limitation for how we want to, how much we want to use this view of the habitus if you want to see social change, religious or otherwise. Okay, second, a pragmatic strategy understands the relation of theology and culture in terms of a distinctive style of using cultural repertories. And about this, I'll just say I am following Catherine Tanner here. Theology is a distinctive style of cultural use. Christian styles of use are fabricated by both organic and professional theologians and are marked by their peculiar ironic function. Theology works to refer all of cultural life to God in order to keep opening cultural space for persons to respond to God. That's basically what Tanner is saying. And I like it. Theology does not then arbitrate a certain kind of cultural flow, you know, religious stuff, or defend the boundaries of a certain subculture. It's a way of doing something with all of culture to open space for an odd way of being a material, encultured creature, a way of living life as response to God. It's ironic use that opens a new kind of meaning. Now, my pragmatic view of Christian ethics suggests that this theological creativity we can expect to be particularly intense where the general task of responding to God occurs in the demands of a particular social problem. The ferment should be still more intense when Christian responses to those demands reveal a failure to make any kind of answer. So Christian ethics can take the account of cultural creativity in Swidler and Bourdieu and theological creativity in Tanner and expect strategic innovation in the gap between overwhelming social problems and a community's life. It can expect that climate change will press moral cultures to invent new patterns of action, and it can work with those attempts, especially Christian attempts, to open a cultural space for the possibility of discipleship in a world of atmospheric human powers. The ethicist's task here is to help Christian social reform projects become more satisfactorily creative, working like a savvy reformer or a community organizer with the values that are already there. As an example, if I were to sit down at a desk and to begin to draw up the sorts of moral resources that would be the best way to respond to climate change, human rights wouldn't be the first thing that I would appeal to. And yet, across South America, there are these groups, especially indigenous peoples movements, that are using human rights in remarkably new ways to not only make human rights claims about direct harms to individual persons in climate change, but to argue for rights for nature, rights for Mother Earth, rights for Pachamama as this kind of spiritual symbiosis of Earth and humanity. Well, that is really interesting. So you're taking this politically liberal device of rights and you're making it do new things. Well, it seems like that's where we ought to... Okay, I'm going to work with that then. I want to critically engage that because that's what's the going strategy. Confronting social problems then is a way of learning theology from how reform projects renegotiate the meaning of their inheritances by redeploying them to interpret and meet the world's needs. I think this is close to the view of Cornel West, whose prophetic pragmatism summons skilled cultural actors to help communities on what he calls a quest for wisdom that puts forth new interpretations of the world based on past traditions. We need organic intellectuals to do that, and of course the most significant and successful organic intellectual in American history was King. It's terrible to quote Cornel West, right? Because everyone actually hears how he actually sounds, and that's not how he sounds. Okay, so West says, look, this is what we have to do. For the prophetic pragmatism, we need this kind of cultural creativity that helps people put forth new interpretations of the world that meet these, you know, social wounds from their cultural inheritances. But what drove King's creativity, I think Karen has some points on this I want to hear about more, but what drove King's creativity, it seems to me, was not just a readiness to learn from his reformed communities around him, you know, to wage ethics through community, as West says, but also a belief that contextual demands mediate, for him, transcendent responsibilities. That belief carries hope that imperfect, incompetent responses from communities will be, can be, might be transformed by God, by grace. Now that hope clearly exceeds the usual pragmatic frame, but it's already there in Tanner's description of Christian style as using culture for responsibility to God. Responsibility names a pattern of interacting with the world as accountable to a God always beyond imminent goods, problems, and possibilities. A beyond that's not superfluous to a community's way of life, it's not reducible to it, but a beyond that sustains the gap, that drives creativity, and allows a community to hope in transformation beyond what they can accomplish on their own. H. Richard Niebuhr noted in The Kingdom of God in America that pragmatists cannot reduce transcendent faith to its instrumentalist function without undermining that very function. I mean, as soon as you recognize it as you know, transcendence is just something that drives creativity, as soon as you do that, then it evacuates the creativity. The creativity of the community, which I'm saying is the object of ethics, depends on that community objectively holding a hope in transformation. King's bricolage was prophetic because he understood the creativity of the movement to be interpreting and answering the demands of the situation as demands of God. Luther Ivory has made this argument. I'm basically following his argument here. What sets King apart from exemplary organic intellectuals of the past, says Ivory, is his God-centeredness. King thought he was learning God's purposes from radical involvement in social confrontations. He combined revolutionary consciousness with a radical pragmatism. So he sought to use the cultural flows around him in a particular way. And for him, that way looked like the way of love, and he knew what the way of love looked like because he had a particular image in his mind of how Christ puts Christ's body on the line. For Ivory, this pragmatism is not... This kind of transformative pragmatism is what keeps King from being the sort of realist who's constrained by immutable historic structures. It's a theocentric pragmatism that sought concrete political opportunities for changing power on the view that God was already working to change power. Now, I think it's fair in one way to say that this is still a pragmatist view, and that King held that the wound of the world was the most apt site to find that creative action of God. In fact, the only way you would find it was through embodied emplacement at that site of the womb. And also because he interpreted God's action through community strategies to bear and heal the world's wounds. You weren't going to find God's action apart from or outside of that. Yet those pragmatic moments were sustained by belief, intentionally and self-consciously sustained. That for King, it was quite clear that a transcendent God was reshaping history. So King could hope to overcome the incompetency of everyday Christianity because of his belief that embodied responses to a situation could be caught up into and transformed by God's drama with history. Belief in Christ, in other words, is key to understanding King's social ethic, but of course key to understanding belief in Christ not as a cognitive idea about a transcendent divinity, but as a lived reading of the movement as participation in the incarnating God. All right, the point here is that for a pragmatic strategy of Christian ethics to ironically engage the inadequate and incompetent responses to contemporary problems like climate change, it needs to rely on a community's beliefs to drive transformative ethical innovation. They don't have to be exactly like King's beliefs, but they need to be able to have that function, that a community will anticipate the transformation of imperfect responses to a demand and to a wound. That means that focusing on the lived aspect of theology cannot become an excuse to overlook constructive tasks of theology. If confessed beliefs play a role in driving the innovations and action that make communities better than they are, then those communities may need professional, trained assistance in understanding how their beliefs can support new patterns of action. In fact, whenever I leave Yale Divinity School, people always expect me to provide some form of trained assistance to their problems, and this is part of my struggle to figure out what that means. But I think it means helping them figure out where they are already responding to how they sense that their beliefs can make them better than what they already are, and making that source of creativity stronger. In the paper, I have a few more pages about what this means for views of church and how there might be kinds of church beyond church, but half of you already heard that, and the other half have heard it through Charles Marsh, whom I quote in that section, so you don't really need that. I just want to end by saying, describing what I've been doing over the past few years in trying to write this book. And I thought it would be important for me to go on the ground, right, and find some communities who are responding. So over the past few years, I spent some time in South Africa looking at how communities were dealing with power and environment and poverty on a race landscape. And I spent some time in Ecuador looking at how indigenous persons are responding to climate change and food sovereignty. And I got myself more involved in New Haven, where I live, around how various kinds of groups are responding to homelessness, looking for these kinds of trajectories and this creativity. But I'm not doing ethnography. And I'm not providing these as concrete examples of what it looks like. I'm really just trying to catch a little inspiration, trying to have a little orientation. So when I went to Ecuador, I was stunned. Wow, people are using human rights concepts in ways I didn't think was really possible. And that makes me, start reading other things. But it's not that I don't think I'm doing ethnography in the same way that I've heard you describing. But I don't have a good methodological way of saying why I went to Ecuador and what I did there, other than saying, they oriented me. I don't know. Anyway, I think I'm actually just going to leave it there, and you can tell me what I'm doing. and to say. That the difficulty of this book that I've been writing and proliferating pages on is how do you write a practical, concrete, pragmatic ethic for overwhelming problems, for problems that exceed the present moral imagination? So, yeah. Or where should I go next for better orientation? Yes.
I have a question. I might have a follow-up question, but and my question—I always say my question is sincere, but I mean it. Crap. But I heard you a handful of times say community, and then you gave these specific examples.
Yeah.
What does that word mean? I don't even know what that means. But
yeah. Yeah, that's a good... Read that section. But essentially, I think, this is a deep ambivalence because if I'm saying Christian social ethics is where there... What? Yes. So if I'm saying it's where there are communities that are using their inheritance to, produce responses that in some way answer the sense of God. And yet I'm also saying, but look, the churches in general, they look pretty pitiable. You don't find it anywhere. I think what you end up having is the kind of double sense of church that we see in Bonhoeffer and we see in King, where there's all kinds of ecclesial reality or moral reality. The real, authentic moral community is outside the church, and yet they both hold on to the church for interpretive reasons. They need that lexicon to be able to say where that real moral community is. So I think that there's, and that's not a solution. I think that's just the. That's a tension that I think runs through our two most interesting social thinkers of the 20th century, because it's a difficult one.
Yeah, I mean, you read, Nancy Fraser and multiple public speakers. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, it just seems like the solution to Habitus is that we're multiple subjects positions, we have multiple voices, and this community that you talk about. I mean, that's why I understand now why you're reading West. You asked me about West before, like, oh, that sounds like, I mean, that's this notion of, like, being disruptive and having multiple voices.
Is there a follow-up?
I mean, that was a follow-up. Just thinking about, like, you know, thinking about Nancy Fraser and multiple public spheres, and that this notion that, you know, obviously, yes, right, that the community is not, and I actually don't mean monochromatic in terms of race, but the community is not monochromatic in terms of, they're not all thinking with the same resources. And so that's why I asked that question about that category. And so, like, Fraser talking about multiple public spheres and a counterpublic, I feel like is really useful, because a counterpublic is still, might be against the dominant idea, but is still committed to being public. And so you talking about really, like, how can you have a problem that challenges the very notion of habitus? Well, her notion of counterpublic, you have a counterpublic that recognizes the dominating structures of the public and don't allow for the experience of the counterpublic. But what makes the counterpublic public, it's counter, but it's still committed to the idea of transforming public spaces.
That's good.
So you need transformation.
Right.
Anyway,
no, that is. I need more lectures.
So, Will, I'm a big fan of this project of yours, because I think it matters. Like, I think it matters what you're working on. I think these are pragmatic problems that exist. And you're working on trying to frame them and shape them and offer solutions to it. And I think part of why you've written so much and wondered so much about it is these are kind of unsolvable on one hand. And I think your book may end up being a step in the right direction without being the whole picture.
Yeah, if it was the whole picture, it could defeat the theory, wouldn't it?
Well, in some ways, yeah. Right? It's going to be a book that's going to be light by carbon offset. Right?
Or you can just buy carbon offset.
I know how you feel about that. Yeah. But I think it's a step, right?
Like, your car has a carbon offset sticker on it.
What else are you going to do?
Right. So what else are you going to do? Well, I think you're going to write this book. Because you can write it, we can't. Right? So it's going to be a step in the right direction for us.
Okay.
And I think part of that for you, like, the Ecuador piece is what I'm thinking about. Like, why did you go to Ecuador? I was talking about this with Manuel before. In Manuel de Tongale's Sacrifice for Africa, he talks about that the greatest failure of Christian social ethics presently is a failure of imagination. Mm-hmm. And I think you went to Ecuador to have your imagination stirred.
Mm-hmm.
Valerie's going to call this the moving of the spirit. Mm-hmm. You know, and others. Right? That you want to see how God was working around the world to see how that informs how God's working for the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have any response to that. Not that I have questions from there, but that's what your presentation would be thinking about.
Mm-hmm. I'll take that as an edifying encouragement. Thank you. Thanks. Yeah.
Just on this.
Again, really more of a comment than a question, but I'd be interested in what you think about it. So it struck me as you were talking, you said that there's a moment where you said the work of an ethicist is to criticize and to cultivate.
Mm-hmm.
But what I heard you saying actually was that the work of an ethicist is to help people see things somehow. So, and that when you're traveling to these different places and you're kind of experiencing imaginative ways, creative ways of kind of putting ideas together and in fact doing something practical, that is helping you to see other situations in new ways, to see new connections. And that maybe one of the themes I've felt throughout a lot of the talks we've had is that ethnography is really good at, can be really good at that, if well crafted. A story or a narrative can help people see things in their own reality they might not.
Mm-hmm.
You have with a clarity that they and that this is can be one way of identifying the wound. So this kind of idea that there can be wounds with us, and we're so unaware of them, like we just don't see them.
Mm-hmm.
But to have a story about ourselves reflected to us through an ethnography can help you see something,
mm-hmm.
which is just the first step,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in this case, it's seeing, I'm learning and seeing through the problem. So the frame here is trying to learn about climate change or homelessness through some form of participation in a community that's responding. So I think what I'm looking for is not so much to understand the story that a particular community bears, but to try and understand the problem in ways that will be helpful to others. Yeah. Of course, the more places you go, and it gets more complicated, right? I mean, the great advantage, actually, of doing, like, eco-theology in a sort of more systematic way that I did before is that you just know, okay, climate change is evil, right? It's a sin against God, and, you know, it's an empire, it's Babylon. Okay, done, right? So you don't have to really think about the multiple interpretations of it, the different kinds of contestations of justice within it. Doing something closer to the ground makes it muddier.
So maybe the idea of seeing seems more static than I need it to.
Yeah.
I think really seeing is something creative and something that happens when you're involved and when you're participating and when you're a witness.
Mm. Hatred or neighbor, what is going on? Yeah.
Yeah,
I make a big thing about that. No, towns, yes, okay. But here's, so towns does that, but how I differ from what I think towns, how she responds to that. And so she definitely says, and William Schweiker does it, and Larry Rasmussen does it. So there's this whole generation of contemporary social ethicists that respond to big problems from what they understand as a description of reality. Right? But in my view, it's what I would call a cosmological strategy, right? So they see how these problems are funded by misuse of religious and cultural symbols, and then they propose solutions for that, mainly at the symbolic level, therapeutic solutions. Right. And I'm trying to work a little bit differently. So I'm trying to work with live strategies of response that may not look for one-to-one sort of relationship between the problem and the symbol, but look for the patterns of action that are sustained by a sort of repertory of symbols. So it's different, but it's much more modest, too. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, I can't say climate change is the evil empire of oil like Michael Northcott does, because he's working this.
But it sounds like you're dissatisfied with some. I mean, when you were talking, I thought, just because my students just read this, of that chapter in Harawas where he talks about save the baby homes.
Save the baby home. I don't know.
Yeah, though it's there's this chapter where he's talking about method, and he starts talking about Jerry Falwell, and this is this very 80s moment where Falwell has these homes for that the church is raising money for the Save the Baby Home, so that young women who get pregnant and don't want to have the baby don't need to have an abortion, that they can stay in these homes for as long as the baby's adopted. And Harawas begins with this kind of, you know, because Falwell's a kook, right? And so basically says that, and begins with this example saying, if Christians are going to develop creative solutions, this is in Harawas, where he says, you know, Christian ethics is not about shoving as much, getting Constantine to swallow as much Christian ethics before, or getting Caesar to swallow as much Christian ethics before Caesar chokes. So this idea that a Christian ethicist's job is not to convince the government or convince the population, but to model creative solutions.
Mm.
And for him, that was the most creative and right solution, even though it wasn't going to have this huge effect.
Mm-hmm.
But save the baby homes, and that's an authentic Christian response, because this is what your commitment is, and this is what you do. And so it's the authenticity of it. It's not for Harawas, and I'm not a huge Harawas fan, but that's what I was hearing. But for Harawas, the criterion is not whether or not it's effective, but whether or not it's true, right? Which is what's irritating about him, I think. But his examples you gave are really true.
Yeah, I'll have to look at that. I'm quite mean to Harawas in this section of the chapter, so that would be complicating. All right.
Anyway, sorry.
Well, I'm just, it seems to me, just from
question. Is this live theology? And I certainly don't have any stake in claiming that, though I'd like you to be part of the journey. But I think it is simply because, live theology seems to me at its basic level is sort of an invitation to look outside of what you call the incompetence of the church, but maybe even the incompetence of theological ethical discourse to probe and understand certain set of questions. Mm-hmm. And those questions have to be identified at the ground level. Mm-hmm. It's not identifiable with a method or an ethnographic strategy or really even an ecclesial kind of aim. But it's a project governed by a vivid set of theological questions that require a kind of research that moves one beyond the inherited discourse of theological and ethical studies, which strikes both of us as having great limitations. And it seems to me that vivid set of theological questions is what's taking you to these places. Mm. It's not a particular method. It's not that you've got this thing scripted out. It's a process of discovery. It's a kind of reportage, even, if you will. But within that set of questions, that set of questions offers you a framework, more or less, within which these sort of underground decisions about how to use methods and ethnography and non-theological ethical sources, kind of make sense as you try them and some fail and you try others and they work and you piece them together in novel ways. That doesn't add up to a model for a method that you can then pass on. But it is a spirit, it is a conquest, it is a theological enterprise. Mm-hmm. That makes any sense.
Yeah. Thanks. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.